House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, May 13th, 2015. There was a work session scheduled for Senate Bill 740. We're moving that to next week because we don't have the paperwork. And we're going to go out of order. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 825A and call Senator Thatcher, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 825A comes to this committee from Senator Thatcher. It's moved its way through the Senate. It has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. The bill grants defendants the right to appear and testify in grand jury proceedings when the defendant has been arraigned on a felony allegation and is represented by counsel. It requires the defense attorney to notify the district attorney in order for the defendant to exercise this right.
Thank you. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and esteemed and large House Judiciary Committee. I'm Kim Thatcher, representing Senate District 13, and you are a mere shadow, Mr. Chair. And he basically said what the bill does, and the concerns that were brought up on the Senate side were that people would be under oath, and people would be without representation. And the fact is, people will not be showing up in these grand jury testifying without consulting with their attorney. And I think that would be very rare and narrow circumstances under which people would actually show up to testify on their own behalf. And it would probably mostly, it would be very helpful in cases where self-defense or defense of property situations occurred, and what the suspect saw, heard, and experienced at that time would be very useful in determining whether it was believed that the self-defense was necessary and whether it was justified. And I think there are going to be amendments coming. Maybe they are drafted already, but there are people in the room that would speak to them, and maybe they can come up here. But basically, this is supported by a wide spectrum of groups, including the American Bar Association, the National Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, as well as the Heritage Foundation, recognizing the right for a defendant to testify during grand jury proceedings. And they're setting up a process to do this because not all district attorneys allow it. Many do, but this would allow for this to occur on a regular basis in a standardized fashion. So I'm not sure if you want to hear from the others.
I have others coming.
Okay, all righty. Well, that's pretty much all I have.
Questions for Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Thatcher, it's nice to see you here. I have some technical questions I'll save for the next panel. But my question for you in bringing this bill forward, was there a particular situation or problem with the status quo that prompted you to? It seems like I could be the grand juries are kind of getting along pretty well. What prompted you to take a look at this?
It just came to my attention that not all defendants are given this opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so this would just create a situation where it would just create a process and make it standardized throughout the state.
Okay. Representative Greenlee.
Yes, Representative Thatcher is.
Senator.
Awesome.
That's all right.
The good
always
old
representative.
Days. Senator Thatcher, Representative Post is over there. Happy you're not as representative anymore, I think. This requires that the defendant be represented by an attorney. Would you support an amendment that would allow the defense attorney to represent the client in the proceedings?
Well, I'm open to what people... There are people who are working on amendments right now who come from both sides of the issue, including the district attorneys and the defense lawyers. And if they would agree to that, then I would agree to that. I would like to have both parties be agreeable before I would weigh in on that.
We'll investigate that with other witnesses. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anybody else have a question? Thank you, Senator. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Jeff Howes, Gail Meyer, and Kimberly McCullough.
Hello. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We would like to thank Senator Thatcher for introducing this bill. There have been quite a few organizations that have done systemic analysis of the grand jury process, and it's always been subject to the complaint that really the grand jury is just simply the rubber stamp of the prosecution in the government, and how to create perhaps a more robust and balanced grand jury process so that the grand jury can function in its historical role, which is to be a bulwark of protection between the Crown and the citizen accused. And so these systemic analysis has been undertaken by the American Association, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Both of them came out with the same point of view. It's appropriate where the target of the investigation wants to affirmatively come forward and present their testimony, that it ought to be allowed. And this also is supported by, think tanks, organizations on all sides of the spectrum, including the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute, thinks the grand jury should be abolished, but in other respects, it thinks it also should be more open and subject to greater consideration of other evidence. The United States Attorney's Manual also states that the United States attorneys, when approached with a request to have the target testify, that it also should be very favorably considered, because otherwise it would look as though that there would be an appearance of unfairness if it were not to consider the target's testimony. So what this bill does basically is it sets up a structure by which this can occur. And I think, Representative Barton, your question was, well, what's wrong with the status quo? And in our discussions with some of the elected DAs about this, they were like, what are you talking about? We would always let these guys in if anybody asked. And the problem is that that's not consistently applied at the line level. There are very many instances where attorneys have approached the district attorney and have said to them, my client would like to come in and testify. Can we get that done? And sometimes the answer is yes. Sometimes the answer is no. What more frequently occurs is the defense attorney will make a communication, my client would like to testify, and then they get a phone call in about 2 or 3 days and says, well, too bad, the indictment's been returned. Too late. So what the effort here was, as I understand from Senator Thatcher, and we definitely worked with her on the bill, was to try and set up a structure, recognize the right, limit it so that it doesn't unduly interfere with the administration of justice, and in the hope that it would frame things such that things become more consistently applied throughout the state. So the bill, as introduced, but then also as subsequently amended, which I don't know what number it will be,
what? I believe A2.
Perhaps A2?
But we don't have them back yet.
Okay. Firstly, it is limited to defendants who are already arrested and arraigned on an information. That's an important limiter, because these are people who have already been arrested on an allegation, and that allegation is now subject to a grand jury proceeding. So what's not subject to this bill are those secret indictment, those secret grand jury proceedings that are ongoing, where somebody may not know that there's an investigation ongoing. So that is not the subject of this bill. This only applies, firstly, when the individual has been arrested and arraigned on an information. They know the allegation has been made. They know what they're charged with. And there's a pause in between the information and the grand jury. So that's the only time when this bill kicks in. Further, they have to be represented by counsel. I think you could debate whether it should be more open to that, but our thought was really someone ought not to testify in front of the grand jury without legal advice, and we didn't know if the DAs necessarily would want to receive that without legal advice. And so then the question became was, well, how do you make sure that this happens in a way that is doable on the defense end, but not unduly burdensome on the prosecution end? And this is where I've engaged in discussions with Mr. Howes, and I just want to publicly thank Mr. Howes for coming forward and being really awesome. In I'll just say it, awesome. In trying to find a middle ground that was going to work for both parties, because it was really difficult to not to thread that needle. So how we have agreed to, and these are now consensus amendments between ODAA and the OCDLA, is that subsection D of the bill is going to be removed. The district attorneys were concerned that this language allowed the defendant to simply give a monologue, their phrase, to speechify, and then be subject to cross-examination. And basically, the concern was if the defendant was going to get in there and testify, they were going to be like any other witness. So you're going to show up, you're going to be sworn, and you're going to be subject to questioning. And we were agreeable to that. So subsection D is being removed. And then as to C, C was dealing with the time frame. And this is where I felt that Mr. Howes was really very cooperative and helpful in coming to an agreement. Basically, the amended language will read that in the event of a scheduling, firstly, there's no obligation on behalf of the DA to do anything to inform the defendant of the right to testify. The defense attorney will be obligated to inform the DA. In this case, my client would want to come forward. And then the question is, well, what happens in the event of a scheduling conflict? And so the new revised language would read, in the event of a scheduling conflict, the district attorney shall reasonably accommodate the schedules of the defendant and the defense attorney if the accommodation does not delay the proceedings before the limits prescribed in ORS 135.070. Subsection 2. I'll talk about that in a minute. Upon request of the defendant, the time limitation prescribed in ORS 135.070(2) may be extended by a maximum of 5 judicial days. The district attorney and the defendant may stipulate to an extension of greater duration. So if it's agreeable to both parties, they can extend it further. And then during that period of delay caused by the scheduling conflict, the custody status of the defendant shall continue to be governed by ORS 135.230 to 295, rather. So basically, as Mr. Howes has structured this, and we think it's a great fix, the current time frame limits from initial appearance to grand jury return date remain in effect. The defense attorney may ask for an extension of 5 days. If they want to go longer than that, the two parties need to agree. And then independent of that, the defendant's custody status is not impacted by this at all. So if they're in, they're in. If they're out, they're out. If they're in and they might be able to get out through a bail hearing, that process can unfold. It's not impacted by this. Representative Greenlick, you mentioned something about defense counsel in the grand jury. That is a reform that is also embraced by the American Bar Association and by the National Criminal Defense Lawyers, I think even by the Heritage Foundation. It is not part of this bill. It is allowed in a few states, not that many. It's always limited to the defense lawyer only counseling the defendant. They cannot ask questions. They cannot affirmatively object to a question. They can't ask a question, but they're able to at least observe and counsel the defendant while they're testifying. Right now, defense lawyers are capable and able, when the DA agrees, to get the client in there. Basically, you don't do that until you fully prepped your client and you anticipate they know pretty much they're going to be able to respond to questions that you think will be coming their way. So this bill doesn't go that far. And we wouldn't want to see this bill not pass because that becomes an issue. I'll just say it that way. So happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gail, how many times in your legal career do you think you would want your client to, let's assume for purposes of this question that the recordation of grand juries passes,
mm-hmm.
your client under oath on record without you being there being cross-examined by Mr. House, for example? It just seems like a disaster waiting to happen.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, as you know, most states record the grand jury. And as you know, this is considered a reform that defense counsels want to employ.
That's what I can't figure this out. Why?
Well, because once the indictment kicks in, the machinery of justice starts flowing and the jeopardy is high. There are those cases when, in order for the grand jury to fully understand the composite factors at issue, they need to hear that other side. And it's a rare instance. So I've done it both ways. I've had my client testify and I've gotten not true bills. I've had my client testify and they got indicted. And there are times when they got indicted and you wondered if you should have had your client in there. You'll hear from another witness, Mr. Jason Short, formerly a prosecutor, now a defense lawyer. Sometimes the DAs will tell you, Gail, this might be one where you want to get your client in there. And then affirmatively on the other side, sometimes you want your client in there, and that's when the check and balance, the haphazard application comes in. Sometimes they'll say yes, and sometimes they'll ignore you until the indictment's already returned.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would love to know, I need to know, roughly how many times there has been a defendant who wanted to testify in grand jury and has been excluded in Oregon. I need to have an idea if that's once or twice in the last decade or if that's a common occurrence. That's very important to me because this session we're talking about a lot of grand jury reform. And that concerns me because we have such a foundational piece of our process here that we're talking about and tweaking. So that's really important to me to even begin to get to a comfort level. The other piece that, and I don't know the answer, and I don't even know that I can think this process through to the end, but there are more attorneys in this room than any room needs, so I bet there's an answer in the room. And that is, if that defendant is in the grand jury, I'm trying to think through rules of evidence pieces for the trial. And if we are to look at the defendant, the counsel of the defendant substituting testimony, are we going to look at other entities being able to substitute their testimony also? But talk to me a little bit about the rules of evidence, how they may incriminate themselves there, but how that would change in a trial if there was an indictment issued.
Okay. Chair Barker, Representative Springer, firstly, with respect to how often does it happen, when this bill was heard on the Senate side, it was combined with the bill requiring recording of the grand jury. So there were 9 witnesses total, a lot of them being defense lawyers, and Chair Przonski had combined their comments on both bills at the same time, so they were testifying on both recording and on this. What was testified to over there was the witnesses were from a lot of geographic disparate areas, metropolitan, southern Oregon, eastern, and they all had the same story. There were a lot of times when they would call and ask a DA, my client wants to get in. What about that? Can we do that? And in 2 or 3 days later, the DA called up and said, too bad, indictment's been returned. The testimony was that happens a lot. Now, in terms of showing this to you, Mr. Short will be coming up soon, and that would be a good question for him. He has a regional practice. And I could elicit emails for you if that's what you would like to see. What I hear from the practitioners in our association is, yes, very common that you get a rejection. Now, in my own experience, I know I can just tell you personally that happened in my practice. You would say, I would like to get my client in, and they go, no, I don't think so.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up on that
point?
Yes, you can. Please, thank you.
And
so could that, and what I want to ferret out there is how many times, and looking at how, and I know there's some amendments, so I'd want to compare with how this bill will cause the process to occur, but when a defendant has been denied that, or the prosecutors call and say, we already have an indictment, is that because the call was made too late, or because we're denying your ability to testify? Those could be two different situations.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, they could. But that's one of the purposes of the bill, is to structure up the time frames. And so the amended subsection C will be pretty clear about the timeliness of the notice. So when the defense attorney provides the notice has to be provided before the filing of the indictment. So a DA could get an indictment in 2 days. So if you don't get your notice in prior to then the bill would say it's not timely. But in most instances, it usually isn't filed that quickly. In most instances, I think Multnomah County, quite frankly, has some of the fastest turnaround of any of the counties. It's usually filed within 5 days. So still, that's pretty quick. And so the agreed consensus amendments here is that if the defense attorney files the notice or provides the DA notice, I'd like to get my client in, and that notice is timely, i.e. it's prior to the filing of the indictment, then the right kicks in, but it doesn't last forever because the train's going to have to leave the station at some point. And that's where Mr. Howes and I were really trying to figure it out. How do we allow this so that if you're a court-appointed lawyer and you're at the office, somebody else is in the courtroom at the time of arraignment on the initial arrest on the information. You don't even know you've got a new client until you come back the next day and you got a file in your box. So how do you get to the jail, meet your client, hear the story, prep the client, really think it through, and get ready to know? I mean, you know, it's tough. So, but the bill would require that you have to file your notice of intent to testify before the return of the indictment, and in some counties that's way out there, and then it would be extended for a maximum of 5 days, and then only upon agreement of the parties would it be extended beyond that. So I personally had a case where we quite frankly rolled it out quite a bit. I don't think my client got in for 3 weeks, but that was with agreement with the DA. I think you asked another question about evidence. Once the defendant is there and testifying under oath, they've waived their right to remain silent. Those are statements. They can come in at trial. I think that's the only real difference.
Please.
I don't know the answer to this, but I would think if a prosecuting attorney would be able to use that statement in court, there's an issue because it can't be cross-examined. How's that work?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, they can be used against the defendant because they're party admissions. So there's a blanket. Somebody makes a statement against their own, you know, if it's a party statement about the allegation, it comes in. And they're a party, right? So it comes in. Yeah.
I had a third part to that.
Okay.
If we would consider counsel substituting, being able to substitute for the defense attorney or for the defendant, would we consider anybody else in grand jury being able to be substituted by counsel?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, I think you're saying, when you say substituted by counsel, you mean represented by counsel?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
the question.
Representative Greenlick asked if there would be an amendment, unless I misunderstood, that counsel could represent the defendant and speak on the defendant's behalf.
No.
Well, then I misunderstood, and I withdraw that question. Then that's not a good question.
But advise the defendant.
Okay.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in case the Court of Appeals ever reviews this transcript, I want to be very clear that the bill that we are reviewing right now does not provide defense counsel entry into the grand jury room. However, on that note, it does in Section C specifically reference defense attorney schedule, even though a defense attorney is not allowed in the grand jury room. What was the logic there that maybe if they were in defense counsel was in trial, they might not have the opportunity to prep the defendant? Is that why defense attorneys called out in Section C.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, I guarantee you the defense lawyer is going to be outside that grand jury door. They just are. And generally what you find in federal court is the allowance for the defendant. Sometimes they just take a break and they go out and they consult with a client and they come back in. So it's the understanding that the defense lawyer is going to be right there outside the door.
I see. And Mr. Chair, just a comment. And, you know, this is an odd thing. Here there's the lobbyist for the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association asking for this bill. It is in the interests of the accused that I am extremely reluctant. I've never practiced criminal defense law, but you don't have to be Clarence Darrow to figure out that having your client cross-examine it on record, under oath, in ways that are coming into trial without you being there, only bad things can happen. And it just seems like there's no better way for an innocent person to go to jail than for them to go in and do this. It makes me extremely nervous on behalf of your clients. And I just want to put that out there.
And if I might respond, Chair Barker, Representative Barton, this is a reform that is very much embraced by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
Wow.
And the American Bar Association got there first. And the reason is, once the indictment is returned, all hell breaks loose. I mean, it just does. And if there is an explanation that can be provided by the target of the grand jury, consider this from my vantage point. I understood that I was under, you know, fear of bodily harm if I didn't do X. That is something for the grand jury to consider before the indictment. And so this is a reform that is very much embraced. And again, it's embraced by a wide spectrum of organizations, but it's fully vetted by the defense bar, and it's a national concern. And there are some states that are doing this. And again, Representative Barton, kind of in line with Representative Springer's questions, this does occur in Oregon. It's not like we're inventing an opportunity that doesn't happen. What the bill attempts to do is structure it so that there isn't ad hoc, disparate application of this around the state.
I'll pass.
Okay, thank you.
Paula. My name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon, and Ms. Meyer covered everything fairly well, so I'm going to keep my comments brief and just reiterate that the historic role of the grand jury process as reflected in the Fifth Amendment is to provide a check on prosecutorial power. The ACLU supports certain minimum safeguards, both to protect that right and then also to comport with the demands of due process. The right of a defendant to appear is one of those procedures that we support. Just for the record, we also do support defendants being represented in grand jury proceedings, but if that's not part of this bill, we still do support it, and we wouldn't also want to hold up the process. I'd also just like to note that response to Representative Barton's questions, that I think the key here is that some defendants have more legal sophistication than others, and there are some clients you would never want to put on the stand, even if you're there representing them. Other clients are very good at representing themselves, and particularly when the facts are such that there really isn't anything that they could trip up on. Certainly, everybody is capable of, we're all fallible and capable of tripping up on ourselves. But if you have a client who is very articulate and good at explaining their situation, and they have a very good explanation for what happened, particularly self-defense situations, and you really trust that client, maybe your client's an attorney. Maybe they've been through legal proceedings before, or maybe they just really get it. Then in a situation like that, where you're like, wow, I could put them in there and there's a chance that they don't have to go through all of this other stuff. I think that in those circumstances, this would be a very valuable tool to have. So that's all my comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Howes. I'm the first assistant to District Attorney Rod Underhill in Multnomah County. I've been a practicing prosecutor for almost 21 years, and I've probably conducted upwards of 800 grand juries. Several times in conducting those grand juries, I've had a defense attorney suggest to me that it would be in their client's interest to testify in front of that grand jury. Never have I rejected that overture. I've always made it happen. I think, you know, an informal poll of the members of my office, past and present, would agree with that and would support that. The types of cases that Senator Thatcher suggested would be appropriate for this type of proceeding are self-defense or defense of property, a situation where something happened, somebody was injured, you know, a prima facie showing of a crime, probable cause to believe that a crime had been committed exists. But a prosecutor would look at that and say, we'll set this for grand jury. We'll take it to grand jury. There was probable cause. And if the defense attorney would make that overture, my client would like to come testify. I don't know of a prosecutor personally that would turn that down. I trust Ms. Meyer when she says it happens, that it probably does. But I would say that the rejection of a defendant's offer to testify in grand jury is even more rare than suggestion that a defendant come and testify. The ODA testified in opposition to this on the Senate side, and sort of for the reasons that I think are mirrored in Representative Barton's first question. Is there a problem? Why do we need this? And it's because of the reasons I just stated, that it is, if it's a problem, it's not much of a problem. But if it's a problem, and taking that for what it's worth, I sat down with Ms. Meyer over the course of about the past week, and we crafted a proposed amendment, which, as Mr. Dietrich said, will probably be A-2, and it does the things that Ms. Meyer described for you and to you, clarifies the time frame. The bill as written simply says that if the accommodation does not unnecessarily delay the grand jury proceeding for more than 5 judicial days, but there's no bookends on that. When does the clock start on that? When does the clock end on that? With the amendment that we've proposed, it does put sort of bright lines around that. There's already an existing statute, the preliminary hearing statute, that says that a preliminary hearing should be held on the fifth day, fifth judicial day after detainment and arrest and the filing of an information. We use that opportunity, that marker, to report to the court whether or not there's been an indictment. So we've got that initial 5 days. Ms. Meyer artfully advocated to me as we were putting pen to paper that sometimes that just may not be enough time for a busy defense attorney to, as she described, meet with their client, ferret out the facts, and make an informed decision about whether or not it would be in her client's best interest to testify in front of the grand jury. So we crafted the amendment to extend that upon the request of the defendant for an additional 5 days. More often than not, if a case is such that the grand jury proceeding would benefit from hearing from the defendant, the district attorney, the deputy district attorney, would be willing to extend that even further. But it needed to have a bright line, a bookend. And, of course, there would always be concerns about the custody status, because right now, and I speak obviously from my experience in Multnomah County, but let's use real days to describe it. If a defendant is arrested over the weekend, the initial appearance on a DA information would be on Monday. That case would generally be set for grand jury hearing on the following Friday. The following Monday would be the grand jury report date, where the prosecutor would tell the court, yes, there has been an indictment, and then on the next day, Tuesday, the defendant is arraigned on that indictment. Depending on the seriousness of the charge and all the other analysis that goes into 135230, the statute entitled Release of Defendants, this would not change that, but just highlights that the status of the defendant's custody would remain to be governed by 135230 and the subsequent subsections of that. I'm happy to answer any questions for you. I imagine you might have some. I'll just say that ODAA is now neutral on this if this amendment gets moved in. I understand Representative Barton's pointed questions to Ms. Meyer about someone like me or better than me having an opportunity to really go after a defendant unrepresented in front of the grand jury. But I think that does a disservice to our mission, our goal, our ethical duties, which is to see justice done. And seeing justice done does not mean tying up a criminal defendant in knots in front of a grand jury in order to hopefully secure an indictment. It's to get to the truth. And I trust my colleagues to do just that. In the times that I've had a defendant in the grand jury, I treat that defendant as I treat other witnesses or victims. I ask them questions. I expect them to answer honestly and truthfully. I think a sort of subset of Representative Barton's concerns, which hasn't been discussed, is will this result in more perjury charges coming out of grand jury? I think that's a legitimate concern. But I think that you know, Ms. Meyer and her colleagues and good defense attorneys all over the state will calculate that risk and will advise their client that under oath means under oath and testifying truthfully means just that. So that's all I have, but I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Excuse me. Did I hear the amendment was going to delete Section D?
That's correct.
Could you explain why we wanted to delete it and then what the impact would be of the bill without D as stated?
Chair Barker and Representative Greenlee, I'm happy to do that. Section D says, as it now is written, the defendant may appear as a witness before the grand jury pursuant to this subsection. The defendant shall be permitted to give relevant and competent evidence concerning the charges under consideration, and after giving evidence is subject to examination. Quite frankly, Representative Greenlee, that's just not the way it's done in grand jury. We don't invite a police officer, we don't invite a witness, and we don't invite a victim to come in and give a monologue, a speech, or anything else. It's a process of inquiring. The prosecutor will inquire, and I have having done it so many times, I have a standard way to begin a grand jury proceeding. They state their name, they spell their last name, I ask a little bit of background, and then we talk about the event in question or the events in question. It's not a cross-examination. It's not. It's more like a direct examination. It's open-ended questions to get the story out. That I would analogize the prosecutor in the grand jury to a guide helping get the story out. I think that if this section remained, that it would turn into a much more adversarial process in that once the defendant, who is, you know, charged with a crime and oftentimes a serious, even the most serious of crimes, the prosecutor would then be almost obligated to start down a cross-examination-like path. It just doesn't happen that way. I think that the system works the way it is.
But it seems to me the reason the defendant would want to give their story is so they could have a chance to give their story. And this depends on the prosecutor eliciting that story without giving them the chance to say, here's why I'm here and here's what I want to tell you. I mean, why else would they want to be there?
Chair Barker and Representative Greenlee, I think that we're almost talking about the same thing. Sometimes the question is, what happened or what happened next? But it's a way for the prosecutor to keep the testimony on track and online.
Further question?
I was just trying to find the language here that essentially says that's what the defendant is asking for, the chance to tell their story. Not to answer your questions, but to tell their story. And it seems taking that away mitigates the purpose of, all right, I'm not going in here to tell my story. I'm going here to answer whatever question the prosecutor wants to ask me, depending then on the prosecutor giving me the chance to essentially tell my story. Although, I mean, if it's like a politician, we answer the same answer whatever the question is. We decide what we want to say, but I don't think that's what's intended in this.
Chair Barker, may I respond just briefly?
Yeah, sure.
Representative Green, like I would analogize it to testimony in open court. When a witness is called to the stand, they're not invited by the judge or by either side's attorney to tell their story. The judge says, you may inquire. He says that to one of the litigants. And that's how our system draws out the story. But
it's your representative drawing out the story as a defendant. So, I mean, if I'm a witness on my own behalf in my defense, I am going to tell my story. You're right. It will be an answer to a question that my attorney has asked me. But the purpose is to elicit, his purpose or her purpose would be to elicit the story from me. We're not even giving the defense attorney a chance to be with the witness, and it is a witness, and it is an adversarial procedure. Once that person's been indicted, it is by definition an adversarial procedure.
Grand jury's pre-indictment.
No, I understand that, but the information has been, I mean, the person has been arrested.
Right, true.
Once I'm under arrest, I have a sense that this is not friendly. This is not there to my benefit. This is there. And if I want to tell my story, then it seems to me Section D gives me a chance to tell my story, and then for you to respond as the prosecutor, however you want. But maybe I misunderstand the whole process.
If I could interject here, Chair Barker and Representative Green, like, thank you for your questions. This language kind of came from a similar statute in New York that gives the accused the right to testify. We agreed to its removal on a few thoughts. Number one, usually you would never get your client in without having discussed this pretty much in depth with the district attorney before you do it. And our thought is, if you really have a very hostile district attorney, you probably aren't going to agree to do this. It's in those instances when we feel the district attorney will have every institutional motivation to open it up and hear what your client has to say. They'll have a motivation to open it wide and hear the client's statements in the client's own words, because those are the words they're going to be using later at trial. They're going to be hearing it later at trial. So let's hear it now. And so we were comfortable removing the language. I can't say that when you read the white papers coming out of the American Bar Association and the National District Attorneys Association, they don't really discuss this point. But they don't contend that the defendant should be a super witness and have rights that other witnesses don't have. So we were comfortable removing the language. In truth, we don't know that in practical application it will make that much of a difference. We do think the district attorneys, once the defendant's in there under oath, on the record, answering questions about an allegation, we think the DA is going to be pretty motivated to let the guy go. Let's hear your story, because I'll use it against you later if it doesn't work. So,
this certainly isn't a grand jury, but we've had witnesses come in and then just take off and talk. And that's what you can't have in a grand jury. Those are pretty regulated proceedings, and you wouldn't want, I don't want to say his name, and start talking about the Pope and the Queen of England,
I don't know what you're talking about.
I think
Chair Barker, real point. I mean, the point of it is, we do have a statute right now that says you can only introduce legally admissible evidence in the grand jury. So it's the DA who has to frame the question to know that it's not going to veer, and they may veer, but you know.
But in Washington County, they run two grand juries all day long, all week long. So, I mean, it's not like something where you have a lot of time just to have somebody come in screw things up, and I'm sure the defense bar isn't going to send somebody in like that.
I had two comments, if I might, Chair Barker. Happy to supplement the record, Representative Springer, in any way, which way you would like. I can elicit some more feedback from my members and give you perhaps emails or something. I don't know how you want, if you want it on the OLIS or if I can just direct them towards you. But happy to supplement the record to make a to answer your question of, is this a rare thing or because.
Thank you. Just don't flood my
mine, and then I'll hand them off to you. Thank you. I'll happy to do that. Just one other comment. Just pointing out that when there is a grand jury proceeding inquiring into officer-involved shootings, that officer has the right to get in there. When I say the right, there isn't a statutory right. They can always get in there and explain their side of the story. And so this would simply recognize that when that is done, it very frequently is a very big factor in the grand jury's decision to indict or not indict. And so we simply wanted to make sure that it could be consistently applied across the spectrum.
Thank you. And then just I say one other point as I think about these. The district attorney certainly wants to win in court at trial. This is before the trial. And mm-hmm. if somebody has a valid reason for whatever happened and is not going to, you know, they don't want to take somebody to trial that they're not going to. Somebody that's innocent.
Correct.
At least that's been my experience.
Isn't it the old statement that a district attorney can get a ham sandwich indicted?
I've listened to that for many years, and I've never seen a ham sandwich indicted.
Should
a ham sandwich be indicted, I'd love to see somebody try to get a conviction.
But there is no question who controls that procedure, and that's what that metaphor is. It's not a...
It's the district attorney's in charge. But to what would it avail them to try to get somebody who they think's innocent or something to trial? I mean, I suppose it's happened, but normally they want to win a trial. They don't want to... The grand jury's not where they win. It's where they get the information.
I understand that.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to... Okay, thank you.
I knew I was setting you up for that.
Thank you.
Jason Scott, short, I'm sorry. If there's anything left to say.
I don't know. That's what's nice about being last. Well, Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Jason Short. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I live here in Salem. I grew up in Salem, but my practice, my main office is in near Lake Oswego in Portland. Really, it's Tigard. And I have an office here in downtown Salem as well. I graduated from Willamette University. I was an assistant or worked with Max Williams when he was a freshman representative and helped to write some legislation and had an interest in that. Prosecuted federal misdemeanor cases with the U.S. Attorney's Office my third year of law school, which was an interesting job. And that was while I was a certified law student doing that. And then I was hired on at the Washington County District Attorney's Office by Bob Herman, who recently was new. Scott Upham was the outleaving DA mm-hmm. for Washington County. Was there for approximately 8 years or almost 8 years. And during that period of time, I handled over 6,000 cases. 5 or 6 of those years was felony practice. Probably a couple hundred grand juries, maybe just off the top of my head. And then about 7 years ago, I left and opened my own law firm. And now I do, as many people say, the dark side, criminal defense work. That's kind of the joke that always happens when I always introduce that.
Like can't put him in prison without you.
Right. You know, just using my Jedi mind tricks on people. And so I've been doing that for 7 years. I prosecuted Measure 11 cases. I defend Measure 11 cases at any time. I probably have at least one or two, if not more. Very familiar with the grand jury process. So I can answer some of your questions there. I've asked for my clients to testify before the grand jury, and that's been denied. That's happened on more than one occasion. I don't have an exact number. I've also asked, and it's been accommodated, and I had that as a deputy district attorney and taking cases to grand jury. I had the opportunity to ask defendant's questions, and I don't think I ever turned that down. I believe the grand jury process is just as Mr. Howes testified to. It's a fact-finding endeavor. It's a truth-finding endeavor. Everyone's under oath. The documents that are presented are documents that I believe would be admissible in trial. So the rules of evidence are apply. And the significance behind that is, of course, a checks and balance type of system. But in the cases where I have had clients testify, all but one ended up resulting in a no true bill. So, and I've had probably not a lot. I think probably six or seven. And in various counties. And from those, almost every single one was a self-defense type of claim. It was almost analogous to a police officer involved in a shooting. Many of those involved a handgun. I can think of just a few off the top of my head, like a road rage incident, a self-defense claim of a shooting, and either walking a dog inside of a home, just those types of scenarios and situations where oftentimes an individual will want to consult with an attorney, maybe give a brief statement to law enforcement, but then will call an attorney to seek some advice. So you may not have a full description from the defendant that's presented to the grand jury. So the officer will testify before the grand jury, I interviewed the suspect or defendant, and he told me or she told me this, this, and this, but then they thought, I should probably consult with an attorney. And then they don't have the full description, and they can't really then go into detail, or they haven't gone into detail about what actually took place and what happened. So then as a deputy district attorney, you're presenting the case to the grand jury, you don't have the full picture, which is very important in situations where you have like an officer-involved shooting or a self-defense type of case where it's very important, in my opinion, for the grand jury to have all the evidence to consider whether self-defense does apply in this situation. And self-defense, like many other types of defenses, as a deputy DA, I'd like to know what that evidence is, because why wait till trial when that evidence has become clear to me, and it's a situation where I'm like, I wish I would have known that back at the grand jury, because now the defense attorney is providing all this in the middle of a trial, and it's a valid defense. And that jury now, the 12-person jury or 6-person, is going to come back with a not guilty verdict and look at me like, why did you take this case to trial? And as a defense attorney, you don't want to show all your cards to the prosecutor. You want to show enough, but at that point, you're preparing for trial and you're calling witnesses, and you may have presented enough where the defense attorney or the prosecutor's in a position where, look, it already went, I already charged it. I've got the witnesses on board. Let's go to trial. They want to win. And so it costs a lot of money. It's a lot of time. It'd be great to get early on, present what I would believe would be very relevant, very important evidence, especially in these self-defense cases. I think with most officer-involved shootings, with what Ms. Myers had identified, I don't think there's been an officer-involved shooting where I haven't read or knew about where the officer didn't testify in front of that grand jury after consulting with an attorney. Either from the personal, he went out and hired, or she went out and hired their own private defense attorney, or it was provided through the organization, through the police department. But certainly they consulted with that, and self-defense was certainly a major factor in why most of those grand juries come back with a no true bill. And just to reiterate what Ms. Myers had testified to just at the end, it's nice to be able to have, at least in my practice where a lot of it involves firearms and self-defense type of issues, to have an equal playing field, just like an officer would be afforded, where the DA's office certainly would accommodate that. So, not too much.
Thank you very much.
Very helpful. Thank you.
We have to wait for the amendment, so I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 825 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 379A.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 379A is something completely different from what you just heard. This is the 2015 probate modernization recommendation from the Oregon Law Commission. It covers ORS Chapter 112, dealing with the disposition of intestate property and wills. This measure has 36 sections, and I'm just going to highlight a few major changes. It creates a process for introducing wills as writing or the revocation of a will when all of the execution requirements are not met, if there's clear and convincing evidence and certain procedural requirements are met, that it's intended to be a will. It creates an avenue for inheritance by a child that's conceived after the death of a parent. It allows continuation of wills executed by domestic partners, should such partners later marry, and it allows express limitation or exclusion of individuals or class within a will. You have on OLIS the work group report from the Oregon Law Commission that details each section by section in great detail. We also have the proposed A4 amendments, which clarify the inheritance for a child conceived from a decedent's genetic material after the decedent's death. There's no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact. It's ready to go today, should you choose to do so.
Thank you. Lane Cherry, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks.
Good to be back. For the record, Lane Shetterly. I'm here today as chair of the Oregon Law Commission. Shauna did a superb job of introducing the bill. I'm just going to make a couple of comments about the process, and then I'd be happy to answer questions. Otherwise, I assume there's no opposition to this bill here. There was none in the Senate. It seems to have been vetted and worked pretty well for what we have been, what we've tried to do. This is the first phase of a longer-term project of probate law reform that has been undertaken by the Oregon Law Commission, dealing this session with intestacy and wills. We'll be following up in successive sessions with projects dealing with the actual probate process, small estates, formal probate, and things like that. It's been a long time since we've taken a look at the probate code like this, and it's well overdue. But foundational to probate is the whole issue of intestacy. That is, what happens. Who are the heirs? What happens when a person dies without a will, or when a will doesn't dispose of all of a person's property? And then, of course, the requirements for creating and revoking a will. Those are the foundational elements of the probate process. John, I mentioned you have the report of the Law Commission. We were very lucky to be able to employ the service, I shouldn't say employ because she does it on a volunteer basis, but to get the services of Susan Gary, professor at the University of Oregon Law School, to serve as a reporter for this group. The work group was a collection of about, I would say, 15 to 20 lawyers from around the state, practitioners in wills and probate, as well as a couple of probate judges who gave us the court's perspective on some of the issues that we were dealing with. You have the report. Shauna mentioned it, so it's an extensive bill with several sections. She touched on the issues that I was going to mention being significant, most significant, I think, that the bill addresses. The amendment, I should just say, is purely a technical clarification. It was always intended that a fertilized embryo that has not been implanted would be treated the same as genetic material, that is, the stuff, for the purpose of heirs who are conceived after the death of a decedent. The way it was drafted, the language really only brought the embryos into one subsection, whereas the amendment makes it clear that the entire section is supposed to encompass embryos that are fertilized but not implanted. So it was just a technical LC fix that didn't really change the bill in any way. With that, I'll stop, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you might want to have, except about the rule in Shelley's case. I still don't understand it.
Anybody have any questions for Mr. Shetterly? Thank you very much.
Can I just say I'm so thankful that Lane Shetterly is at the Law Commission and we are not doing this bill in this committee on our own.
Yeah.
Can I ask?
Oh, no.
What is the issue on the on the embryo now?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick. What we've done, Oregon law has always recognized children who are born posthumously, that is, conceived at the time of the death of a decedent but then born after, and Oregon has always said that they are heirs. I mean, a child doesn't have to be living at the time that a person dies as long as they're conceived. Well, of course, the last time we touched this this subject, you didn't have things like sperm banks and in vitro fertilization and the possibility of fertilizing embryos and then freezing them for a period of years. And so the question is, now that we have that technology, and this is one of the modernization aspects of that this bill addresses, what do we do about those? Are those, if that genetic material is later used to create a child, or if that embryo is later implanted, is a child born from that implanted embryo or that genetic material an heir or not? It's just purely an issue that technology has given us that didn't exist before. So we have addressed that in the bill, and basically the answer is they may be. If the donor, the decedent, executed a writing that stated they intended that the genetic material be used, that children born of that genetic material be considered an heir. It also creates a time limitation within which that genetic material must be used or the embryo implanted, so that you have the ability to actually close an estate and not leave it open for 10, 15 years, because, of course, you can use those a long time. So we've created basically parameters around which genetic material may be used to fashion an heir not only born but actually conceived after the death of a decedent. And so that's what that section of the bill does. And it really is just an expansion on what has always been the law relating to children born after the death of a decedent. But now that we have the ability to have conception after the death of a decedent, we needed to address that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
All right. Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 379. Open a work session.
Mr. Tara, I move the A4 amendments into Senate Bill 379A.
Wherever you said it, Williamson moves the -4 amendments into Senate Bill 379A. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing that's ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 379A as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 379A as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Again, any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
How about simply carrying it on the floor?
Yeah.
Any more?
Representative Barton.
Carry it.
With the courtesy of the House.
Yeah. Representative Barton, carry it.
I want lots of questions.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 315.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Senate Bill 315A comes to us from the Senate Interim Committees on General Government and Consumer and Small Business Protection. This bill establishes that a person engaged in the business of selling a used firearm may use either a manual or electronic transfer register. It provides that the register must be approved by the Department of State Police. The bill mandates that the electronic register be provided in hard copy to a federal agency within 24 hours of the agency's request, and it establishes that an ordinance described in the bill may be adopted and implemented by the governing body of a city or a county. There is no revenue and no fiscal impact to this bill.
Okay, and we will not be moving this bill today. Kevin Stewart, Roger Beyer, and Paul Romaine, please.
Okay, between two guys.
Gonna block the end.
Check them for weapons before I say
no need to check.
Check the committee for weapons.
Yeah.
Go ahead, start.
I might as well start. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine with the Romaine Group with my daughter, and we're here representing the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. We thought Senate Bill 315 was a very simple bill that would simply change a very small part of the law and make it convenient for everybody involved. And we actually told the client that this was the simplest bill of the ones that they wanted, and the other ones, which have already passed, by the way, thank you very much, with no dissent, would be the more difficult ones. We were wrong. what I learned was that anything that deals with firearms tends to have unintended consequences, or maybe people seeing things in there that don't really exist. What happens today if you go into a pawn shop and you basically are transferring a firearm, buying it, selling it, pawning it, taking it back? We have to fill out a form. It's a manual form. You get a register from the state police. You fill out a form, and you keep that form. All this bill was intended to do, and we think it does, is allow us to do that electronically. When the federal government, when people would come in, feds would come in and want to see the stuff, they could go to the book that we had. Well, if we're not keeping a book, we have to be able to print it out within 24 hours of a request. That was all that was intended here. We believe that's all it does do. But we have no objection if you want to repeal the whole statute, because that also accomplishes an objective, which is we don't want to have to keep a manual register. We want to be able to actually bring the technology forward into the modern era. What you have in front of you, which I passed out, is just this form that we have to fill out. There's no attempt to make people do more than they're doing today. There's no attempt to send information to people that already can't get the information today. It's a very simple bill. We understand, anytime you even mention the word firearms, things get complicated. And I think the people from the NRA will testify, we have no objection to what they want to do. If you want to repeal the whole thing, there's a question whether actually the statute is necessary. But if you keep the statute, then please pass this bill so we can do it electronically, not manually. Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin Starrett, Oregon Farms Federation. Unfortunately, it is more complicated than that, and there's a number of issues here. First of all, we don't know yet how this existing statute is going to intersect with 914. This 941, I'm sorry. This is also, unfortunately, as existing statute, is another registration scheme, which we oppose. This bill adds to it a federal nexus, which we think is extremely dangerous. I had a conversation earlier today with a sergeant at my police department. He never heard of this requirement and has never received a single communication from a gun shop or pawn shop when people did this. I've spoken to gun dealers who've been in the business for 50 years and were not aware that this statute existed and had never complied with it. Later today, after visiting the police, I visited a pawn shop, and the owner owns two, was unaware that this statute existed and had never complied with it. And the fear I have is that because so many people are unaware of it and not complying with it, once we add this federal provision into it, now we're opening up them up to increased liabilities because they don't know it exists. So with the 941 nexus and this federal offering this information to the feds, I think it's really dangerous. And I think it's important that you understand we have two completely different systems here or setups for recording firearms. An FFL, a federally licensed dealer, whether he be a pawn shop or a gun dealer, is required with every firearm that comes into his inventory. That has to be entered into his inventory. That's one of the problems we had with 941. It's not a simple trade. That dealer now owns that gun. Once it's in his bound book, in his register of firearms, the feds have access to that on any compliance audit, just like they do now. But transmitting this information is not required anywhere by the feds. Now we're offering it to the feds. The statute serves no purpose. We believe it probably predates our existing background check system. So it doesn't serve any purpose. It doesn't provide any information. To the best of my knowledge, the police departments aren't doing anything with it. And so while I'd love for people to be able to do it electronically so that instead of having to walk across the office and drop the form in the garbage, the police can just press delete. But what we really need to do is simply repeal the statute since very few people are using it, and it serves no purpose. And this, I think, just complicates things.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the NRA. I would agree with what Kevin just told you. NRA, when this bill passed the Senate, we took no position on the bill but testified in front of the Senate committee that we think a better fix would be to repeal the statute than to fix a statute that is unnecessary and duplicative to federal law and requirements which are already required by gun dealers, and this bill does affect all gun dealers, not just pawnbrokers, anyone licensed for selling the firearms. So at this point in time, the NRA has decided they're going to oppose this bill as drafted and would support an amendment which would just simply repeal ORS 166.427, which is the statute, because we don't think it is necessary and we just puts extra burden on gun dealers, and which is unnecessary. So with that, I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Okay. Are there any questions?
Could I make just a clarification? There's no requirement in this bill to upload anything. What all this bill says is we have to keep a record for the law enforcement folks. We keep it at our place of business. We keep it right now. We have to go to the state police, and they approve a form, and you see it. And basically, we keep a book. There's no requirement we give it to anybody. We just keep it. So it's available for law enforcement. What this says is that thing we keep can be electronic, and just we can print it out if necessary if somebody wants it. That's all we're trying to do. But again, we have no objection to getting rid of the whole scheme.
You still have to keep records for the feds.
We still have to keep records for records for the feds, but there's no requirement that we do it manually. We could keep it we could keep it electronically.
Chairman Barker, the records that are required for the feds are the bound book. Everything that comes in and goes out, and that is available to the feds anytime they choose to do a compliance audit. But what this language is saying, providing these copies of this information, which the feds don't require at all, would be giving one more available registration scheme that would be available. The feds can ask for it anytime they want. And as Roger and I said, we don't see why the statute needs to exist at all. As I said, many people aren't using it, and the police aren't taking advantage of this information. And so what purpose is being served by its existence?
Okay. So the book they do keep, I'll ask you, would you care if that was electronic rather than a piece of paper?
It can be electronic now. The ATF will allow you to keep your inventory. I think they actually have approved software for that. Okay. But that's different from sending something to your local chief of police. And in some cases, for example, there's a gun shop in Donald. Well, they don't have a police department. So now he has to go send his to the Marion County Sheriff. But once again, most of them don't even know the statute exists and aren't complying with it.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to point out to you on subsection 2 of the current law, this bill doesn't change that, but it requires that the gun dealer on the day of the purchase be hand-delivered or mailed to the local law enforcement authority. That's current law.
Right.
So that is what we don't think is needed. It's not required, and it serves no purpose.
And again, Mr. Chair, if I might, sorry to prolong this agony, but the register right now is manual, and we have a requirement to send that up. But again, the requirement to send to local law enforcement in that would only be for a manual register. If you have an electronic register, it's not required to be sent up through the pursuant to this bill. But again, we go back to, if you don't feel this section of the law is necessary, we would love for you to get rid of it. But if you do keep it, please allow us to do it electronically.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
On line 16 and 17 of the bill, this talks about providing it to a federal law enforcement agency within 24 hours. Is that, I think that's what you're talking about on the federal authority, is that?
Yes.
How is that intended?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, yes, what happens today is the feds will come in, they'll want to see, and it's very easy for us to show something, it's already printed out. Rather than if they request it, we'll print it out for them. That was one of the things we agreed to do. If they want it, we'll print it out. We have 24 hours to print it out.
I see. It's only on request.
Right. It's on request. And again, it's only uploaded if there's a local ordinance that requires us to upload it.
And does the city of Portland have that?
I don't know for sure. We were supposed to have Pawnbroker here to answer questions, and you got me instead. Sorry.
Okay, so it's only upon request, as in line 16. Yeah. Federal agency asks you to send it. You have 24 hours to get it.
Right. But again, if
not regularly sending it.
No. But again, if it's if these gentlemen are correct and it's not necessary, by all means, do away with it. Just please don't leave it on the books the way it is today. Thank you.
Sure.
So what is the difference between, what different information is required by this statute than the federal law? And it does concern me when I find out that firearm stores are not following current law. It's concerning to me. So what's different?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williamson, I really couldn't answer that question.
The federal law requires that all firearms in an FFL's dealer be entered into his what they call their bound book, that the ATF can examine and see, are those guns actually in the store, have they been sold, and to whom have they been sold.
But it has to be a bound book, or it can be software.
It's always the term that's used for it is bound book, and it traditionally, until recently, that's literally what it was.
Right, but what we're talking about is paper versus electronic. So I just want to make sure we all, and when you say bound book, you are also talking about software that it's approved by the ATF.
Yeah, there's inventory software that ATF has approved, but this requirement to track and provide the make for right now, Oregon is one of the few places that demands that a seller of a gun provide the make, model, caliber, and serial number of the gun to the point of contact, which in our case is the state police.
So that is additional information required by Oregon law that is not required by the ATF.
That is correct. If you do a background check in a state that does not have a point of contact like the police, they determine that you are eligible to purchase the firearm, but they do not maintain a list of the serial. They don't even ask for the serial number of the gun. This statute, which requires that this information be transmitted to the local law enforcement, is nowhere requested or required by the feds. So to create it and then say, oh, we've created this additional registration scheme, and we're going to give it to the feds anytime they ask for it, goes well beyond what's necessary. We have to provide them with information about what's in our inventory in the traditional way that we've always done it. But we don't have to go to the feds don't ask us to go to the local police every time we get a used gun. And I presume the reason that existed in the past was to determine if a firearm was stolen. But that doesn't matter anymore, because when you take a used gun into your inventory, you go to the state police and run it against stolen guns anyway. And the local police aren't asking for it. No, as far as I know, don't want this information. So this registration of used guns is above and beyond what is required by the feds to track inventory of guns.
In a pawn shop, a new pawn gun, they do a background check.
I know plenty about background checks, don't you worry.
When you come back to get it, in 2 weeks, you have to go through it again. So, okay, no further questions. Thank you very much, panel. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I'm sorry I did not sign up, if it's okay. I just, given the conversation, and I did testify over on the Senate side, we were responsible for adding the little language at the end asking that there would be the ability for the local ordinance to be written because of the existing preemption on cities and counties to actually be regulate the transactions of used firearms. And so we needed that little rider, if you will, to say that the carve out could be that the local ordinance mentioned in the body of the bill could actually be written by a local government. And I was made aware of it because in Lane County, the Sheriff's Department buys into a system called RAPID, which is owned by the City of Portland. We, as part of that consortium, police officers actually would go out to the pawn dealer or the secondhand gun store and collect these paper documents, bring them back to the agency, and then enter those into the RAPID database. As police agencies shrunk, especially in Lane County, we didn't have the people to do that uploading. And so we've got boxes of these records that, you know, that volunteers work through, but it's not very rapid for the RAPID system. So when we found out about this bill, we liked it because it puts the onus on the if we can write the ordinance, puts the onus on the uploading to occur right at the point of sale, and everything should be quite nice. I did want to just, given your conversation, I don't know that much about RAPID, but I am reading a little blurb here on the internet about RAPID. It's actually even got some national significance, but it designed to handle pawn, secondhand, and metal recycling dealer transactions in an attempt to track stolen property. Program also has the ability to track vehicles sold to automotive dismantlers, serves as a central repository for transaction data, and allows an investigator to search online for a suspect or stolen item. And this officer from place that developed this thing or uses it says, the nice thing about the system is a patrol officer can query the system at any time and does not have to depend on a detective to provide the information, and searches can be very specific. As resources diminish, we have seen a reduction in our detective unit, and crimes against person usually take precedence over property crimes. This technology can be used to leverage limited resources. What I'm taking away from this is that it is something that a patrol officer is able to access and provides sort of a quicker way to gain information about stolen property, not specifically only guns.
On firearms, they go into the NCIC, right? They may have a different name for it now, but the National Crime Computer, and they never come out. So all you have to do, all the officer, and I mean, I worked for Portland where we had a lot of detectives, and the officers checked them all the time. Yeah. And you just do a query, and it'll tell you whether it's stolen or not, and model and serial number, and it'll, you know, anyway. So it seems to me like this may have been something from the past that is really not as much relevancy anymore, but we'll look into it.
Quick question.
Yeah, question.
Mr. Chairman. Okay, I just, what you were just talking about, maybe I lost something. What does RAPID have to do with this particular bill?
The way I understand it, Chair Barker and Representative Post, is that at least in Lane County, we buy a subscription, if you will, to RAPID in order to be able to use it. But it also, it's sort of a two-way street. The second-hand stores, the pawn shops, that property, not just guns, but there's a lot of stuff that goes up into RAPID. And so it's used by the local police agencies to track used property transactions in addition to get bill. This bill in particular, I believe, is only addresses the used firearm.
Right.
And I don't know if it would be useful for other property transactions at a pawn store. I don't know if those are not allowed to be done electronically or not, but given the conversation today, that's one of the reasons why I asked to come up.
No, I just said the information off of here, as I understand it, goes into RAPID. Yeah. So that's the connection between this paper form and the system.
Right.
And it sounds like volunteers in Lane County.
Exactly. Chair Barker and Representative Williamson, in a perfect world, it's supposed to. And
that's
it just doesn't very rapidly occur.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 315A. No meeting tomorrow, and we are adjourned. No meeting tomorrow, and we